Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One from Eagle Speak. As a reminder to those who are joining us live, make sure and join the chat room. It should be at the bottom of the show page if you're accessing us that way. And you can roll in with the usual suspects as they line up. If you're new to Midrats and you want to catch up on the shows you've missed, or if we go a little long today, you wanted to see what we said after the top of the hour, or just wanted to delve into the archives, you can find that over at the show page at Blog Talk Radio, or you can subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes. Now on with the show. Our guest today was scheduled to be, and may be in the future, Amy Myers Jaffe. She's the Wallace S. Wilson Fellow in Energy Studies and the Director of the Energy Forum at the Baker Institute, author and Associate Director of the Rice Energy Program at Rice University. We're having a little trouble getting in touch with our guest, so I'll be popping out now and then, which means I leave Eagle One to pontificate while tap dancing on his own, and I'll try to reach her and bring her on board. But until we can get Amy on, we're just going to move forward and talk about a few of the items that have popped up in the last week, and we look at coming in the upcoming week that are going to be of interest probably to our listeners. And Eagle One, I think as part of the as Navy team, that we should probably take a moment and mention the loss of the SEAL team in Afghanistan along with the air crew in the Chinook helicopter. They're still coming in with the numbers. But I think we'll know all the details later, not that that really matters, the fact that we've lost it. But I think it does highlight one of the sketchier parts of what we do for a living and the equipment we do it in. You know, you look at the Chinook carries a lot of people. The C-17 carries a lot of people, especially if you're doing a airborne assault with them. And you look at the Navy side, the LPD-17, compared to a lot of other amphibious ships, it carries a lot of Marines. And if the enemy gets a vote, and if they get a little lucky or a little good and we take a hit, we're going to lose a lot of people. And I think that's something that everybody, I don't know if accept is the right word, Eagle One, but it is part of the business, isn't it?
Yeah, unfortunately it is, and it's something we tend to forget because we fight such clean wars, but it is one of the risks of aerial flight. It's one of the risks of carrying that many people on one aircraft into a danger zone, and it's a risk of war. It's a tragedy, and we all hope the best for their families, and we'll move on in the finest tradition of the services, of course.
Absolutely. And I don't want anybody to take my comments as a hit on the Chinook. I think that's one thing that we have taken away from, especially the Afghan conflict. I know our allies have, especially the Canadians, the incredible force multiplier that dual rotor aircraft is. She's really a valuable helicopter, troop transport that becomes problematic, but she's really been a great asset, as she's been for decades in our service. It just kind of comes along with the line of work.
Yeah, there's no defense against some things. It's and one of those is rotors and RPGs, and we just have to accept, unfortunately, that there's going to be some loss. It's a shame that it's such a highly trained group of Navy personnel, but it is one of the costs of doing business, sadly.
Yep, sure is. The on kind of a different topic, something that I think is flown under the radar, mostly because the news has been dominated by the really since 1917 when we got upgraded, that our debt rating has dropped from AAA, that and, of course, the loss of the SEAL team. But when this whole thing started back in March over at the Naval Institute blog that Eagle One and I also contribute to, for those that are familiar with it, mentioned that if you really wanted to do things right off of Libya, because of the distances involved and the cost to do it from land involved, that I thought the carriers would play a larger role than they did. Of course, for reasons best known in D.C., neither good or bad from my point of view, we decided to keep our big carriers off. And, of course, the British no longer have a carrier capability. The Italians threw their little carrier at it for a bit until they decided to go home. But the French have really done a lot of work off the Charles de Gaulle. And the French announced, really nothing of any surprise to people in the Navy, that, you know, Big Charles, she can't stay out there forever. She's got to go home for maintenance. Anybody that is familiar with carrier operations know that they just can't stay out there that long and continually operate. They need to come home, especially when you don't have much of a bench. And so she'll be coming home, I think, on the 10th or the 11th, effectively leaving everything from an air perspective, besides a few of the helicopters off the coast, being done from shore-based aircraft. When you look at that Eagle One, and you also look at the really one of the last announcements that Admiral Mullen's going to make as chairman, he came out last week and repeated what he first said, I believe, back in late April. So he's been consistent on this. He says that we are effectively at a stalemate in Libya. Do you see this stalemate as something that was avoidable? Or did we really just make this up as we went along, and when things didn't work out for the rosy scenario, we just continued to hope?
Avoidable, and I think when you first put the post up that you had on the Naval Institute blog about the operations in Libya, I think my comment at the time was that quote from Fehrenbach, which is you have to put troops on the ground. You have to be boots on the ground to control the area you're trying to go for. And it's simply the rebel forces have not been sufficient to be the boots on the ground. You need a professional military force. You need to aggressively go after the bad guy if he's a bad guy, and you're not going to zap him from the air. And it's always a mistake to assume that you can do that. We've had this fight with the Air Force from, 1917 till to date about whether or not any other force is needed. And if you need to have yet one more example of the insufficiency of pure air power, this is that case.
Yeah, I thought the British position was really it was absolutely sad and a little bit pathetic. They're about, I used to think 5 years, maybe it's just 1 or 2 years in front of us when it comes to a budget crisis, but they've really leaned in and tried to address their imbalances more than we have recently. And obviously what was already a smaller defense investment has gotten even smaller. And so they got rid of their carrier power. And a lot of that mirrored, if you recall, one of my little periods I like to read a lot about and have since I was a teenager was the Falkland Islands conflict. And when they got rid of their standard conventional aircraft carrier, which gave them their fighter ability and their strike ability, a lot of that was based on a white paper that came out in the late 70s, pushed by the Royal Air Force, where they advertised their ability to do everything that needs to be done from shore. And a similar salesmanship came out this time. And then right after the Falklands War, they had a lot of good scholarship about what a horrible argument that was, how it was proven in the South Atlantic that just doesn't work. But I guess if you fail once, try again. The Royal Air Force won that argument. And so you have the Royal Navy, no fixed wing capability, and they really won't until the F-35 finds its way there. So that leaves us with our relatively capable allies. The Spanish have a carrier, but they haven't left the Western Med to any extent. The Italians, I won't say anything else about the Italians. You can read the reports themselves. They speak for themselves. So that leaves really us and the French to have that ability to give effects from the sea on carriers. But I think another interesting, I don't know, I think it may have been you, maybe another one of my listeners, pointed out when you look at open source what the targets were in the initial campaign, they were all along the coast. Perfect targets for naval surface fire support. But I would presume there's been some surface fires on the coast, not that many. But I guess part of the problem is the fact that from a targeting perspective in the last decade, that the targeteers are so used to having making the JAGs comfortable with, this is a laser-guided weapon, this is a GPS-guided weapon, this is precision weapon from the air, while even though they are very accurate, anything coming from a surface ship is generally considered to be dumb. Do you think that had a lot to play into it? Was the ROE and the targeteer satisfying the lawyers that, as we know, are looking over every strike package? Is that why we've seen the surface forces basically in the background?
Well, that may be one reason. I mean, I don't think we have sufficient, any country these days has sufficient naval gunfire capability to do what should have been done, which is to, you know, the accuracy of a 5-inch gun from a destroyer historically has been pretty darn good. I don't think, and we're in the days when we had 8-inch guns or 16-inch guns, you can drop things fairly close and you can repeat it with great rapidity and with a larger volume than you get from aircraft fire. But we don't have that kind of capability, in addition, which I'm not sure what kind of logistics train they have for their destroyers. But again, you know, the sustainment of a gunfire support operation requires ammo ships or some kind of ammo train, plus having the stuff back home to ship forward to put into effect. And I'm judging by the way they seem to have run out of a lot of guided weapons. I'm not sure how good their supply train has been anyway.
Yeah, our good friend from Poland brought up a good point here. I posted this video back when, what was it, cast iron or whatever the Israeli action, or cast lead. Anyway, throwing something ashore. The Israeli action off of Gaza, they had some great video from their patrol boats where they were able to do very accurate surface fire support. That's modern equipment. But you're exactly right. You look at the surface fires that we did off of Vietnam, which is very well documented, as it is off of in World War II, even on that technology, very accurate, very precise, and, you know, consistent. Whereas an aircraft can come in, you know, pickle a few bombs on the target, and then it's got to go home eventually. You know, you'll send reconnaissance afterwards to evaluate the target. You'll look at the video coming back from the aircraft, try to guess that. But a surface ship can sit there for days on end going, okay, I think we got them. Let's see if anything moves. And if it moves, they hit it again. There's been a little bit of write-up in the British press that I've seen about some of the surface fire support. I have not seen much written up on it, but I don't think that's any conspiracy. I think, at least from my perspective, you know, let me know what you think here. But the reporting on the operations in Libya has been beyond superficial. I really have not seen a detailed explanation or description of what's being done with the taxpayers' money. Because everybody can say NATO and allied operation. But anybody that talks to somebody that works in the accounting department with NATO or with any conflict knows that that is overwhelmingly U.S. dollars that is pushing through. Is this seemed a little bit low-key intentionally, or do people just not care? And on that note, I'm going to try to call our guest for a second, and I'll come right back.
Well, I think the administration has not made a point of advertising what's going on in Libya. It doesn't reflect well on them, and I think that's part of the reason. And I think there are a lot of other factors. The media is busy elsewhere, and there's also what seems to be somewhat of a rising effort to get us into action in Syria. So we have lots of things on our plate, and the media is distracted very easily by bright, shiny objects. So we'll have to see how the how this works. And yeah, looking at the chat room, guys, I do recognize you're talking about the gunfire.
Hey, you have reached the Jaffe. Please leave a message.
I hope everybody could hear that. That was wonderful. All right. Sal should be back in a second. Yeah, I'm surprised that that we haven't had more gunship developed for these types of operations, especially given we keep noting that 80% of the world's population lives within X miles of the sea. Gunfire support is probably the least expensive and relatively highly accurate system for putting ordnance on target.
Well, I think y'all probably got a little bit of the answering machine there. I didn't quite put it off into the side room real well.
It was a good answering machine, though.
Okay, well, you know, it's quality. That's as y'all probably gathered, we still have to get in touch with our guests. But life is busy on occasion, and we always wear our tapping shoes when we come to the show.
Well, you know, we should talk a little bit about her, about what we were going to talk about. Because it is the topic people dialed in for.
Absolutely.
And, let me kick it off. The reason that she was invited was there's a paper that this Baker Institute put out for their energy forum. It's called Shale Gas and U.S. National Security. I linked to it both on the Naval Institute website and on my home website. And the gist of the paper is that because of recent developments, and I'm speaking now as an old oil and gas company attorney. I spent a substantial part of my life working for a couple of major oil and gas companies in Houston. The last 10 years or so, there's been a development in the ability to drill into the shale portions of some of the subterranean part of the United States, and through the use of directional drilling and some advanced frack systems, frack being the system for cracking the rock down there, that we've been able to release substantial amounts of gas from this shale. This technique has led us to develop areas that were thought more than 10 years ago to be, we knew they were there, but they were thought to be undevelopable, if you will. But now it looks like we have been able to crack this system, get in there, and find a huge amount of this gas. And this natural gas is of such a volume that it relieves the United States from the need to import gas by using LNG carriers. It may allow us to export some gas, and it's not just the United States that where this is working. Poland, it turns out, has a huge potential reservoir of this shale gas. They have signed contracts with the various super energy companies such as Chevron and Marathon and Exxon and the whole slew, and they're developing that field. And the net result of this, the reason this relates to national security, is because we've developed this massive amount of gas that we had not known that we could get to before. We have created an internal security net of energy that is on our shores, and that means we also don't have to maintain, to the extent that we've had to, an open ocean to make sure that oil from some areas of the world, not of all of which are totally friendly to us, gets back to our shores. Further, this amount of gas being discovered in various countries also limits the ability of countries like Russia and Iran to blackmail the West into doing what they want, because they had a monopoly on the gas that was flowing to Europe, or at least a substantial amount of the gas that's flowing to Europe. And as you may recall, a couple of years ago, the Russians did shut down the pipeline that went through the Ukraine due to a dispute with the Ukrainians, and there were people freezing in the dark in Europe. So this is a big deal. This is a tremendous geopolitical security issue and a huge security issue for the United States.
I agree, and we kind of mentioned to when you and I were talking in the pre-show that when we were first looking at this topic, I was going, interesting, okay. But the more I thought about it, and the more I realized this is a great topic. And, we'll try to get Amy some other time if we have to. We can't get her this time. But because it's, energy security is one of those things, a lot of times, especially in our little blogs and our little show here, we talk about the trees and the moss and the leaves. This is the forest when you're looking at energy security. Without access to sources of energy at market prices, it affects everything. Your ability to heat your home, the ability to produce fertilizer, the ability to transport your food, your base economy to be able to be competitive. It's all wrapped up in there, and it seems that in some weird twist of fate, the least enlightened parts of the world seem to be most blessed with this, the weapon that they can wield against others that threatens an existential threat to a culture. When I first became aware of this topic, it's, as the elder cohort of Gen X, but boomers have seen this even more. I noticed a few years ago, I've seen this show before, because we all grew up with Three Mile Island and the China Syndrome. It seemed that every time that a new and affordable energy source was made available, the usual suspects would come out and protest it. Most people are familiar with the anti-nuclear. But also, the book Cape Wind describes it real well. When they were looking at building some wind farms in parts of the country that actually makes it viable because it's continuous and ongoing, a lot of protests against that. In places such as Maine and elsewhere where liquefied natural gas, you need the terminals to bring them in, even though LNG in Europe, they have cars that run on LNG. You pull into a gas station, you've got unleaded premium diesel and LNG all wrapped up together. Big protests against building those terminals. And we've also seen recently couple of the documentaries and investigative journalists going after fracking, which is one of the methods that we're accessing this new. And is it just me, or have we really seen this story before? Besides a knee-jerk reaction to new Eagle One, do you see why the same suspects keep coming up whenever it looks like we found another energy source that we might be able to tap at and become more independent as a nation when it comes to our energy needs?
Yeah, they have their own vision of the future for the United States, and it does not involve any kind, apparently, or very limited amounts of fossil fuel. And their worldview is such that I'm not quite sure where they think energy comes from, but I do note that that any little concern they have, and the concern with the development of the shale gas has been that it may cause the release of methane into aquifers or water supplies. There was some instance of that up in upstate New York. Turns out it's probably the casing for the well rather than the frack job causing further cracks that allow this stuff, which is most, for the most part, like in Texas, is down about 13,000 feet, well below the aquifers that are used by normal human beings anyway. And so there, you know, the concern is that somehow we're going to cause further pollution. And they point out that natural gas, even when burned, is not a totally free from polluting. But given the other choices we have, coal, which when burned, unless you scrub it extensively, releases mercury, plus all the, you know, the other greenhouse gases, if you worry about such things, into the air, we have all, you know, we have in the United States, I mean, we have a sufficiency of gas, oil, and this shale gas and other things to be completely energy independent, and yet we're on a go slow mentality as far as developing it. And I'm not, and a lot of it is in these environmental concerns, some of which are caused by apparently the ability to measure things to a finer level than we used to be able to do so.
Yeah, I was talking with one of my acquaintances who is a little bit to the left of Ralph Nader. I love her to death, but anyway, she is what she is, but she's very excited about, she wants to, I guess she's one of the 125 people that wants to get a Chevy Volt and the Nissan Leaf, I think it is, talking about all this green technology. Well, she happens to live in Northeast Florida. And I said, you know, when you plug that in, your car is coal-powered. That's where Northeast Florida gets its energy from, the coal plant. So your beautiful Leaf is, you know, Victorian era London tooling around town. So there's a lot of feel-goodism about it that I don't think really survives the follow-on question, not to mention the fact that if you really want to be energy efficient, instead of spending $40,000, why don't you lean in and find a way to get one of those nice Volkswagen turbo diesels to get a ridiculous amount of miles per gallon. Hey, we just got our friend to dial in. Oh, wait, she just went away. Let me try to call her back. Eagle One, can you tap dance for a minute? I'm going to give her a call. I'll be right back with you.
Yeah, let me say that I lived in Turkey when I was younger, and in the winter, Ankara, where I lived, was dependent on soft coal to heat many of the buildings and stuff, and the city had this fine brown haze most of the winter because it sits in these hills, and I'm more than familiar with the damage to your lungs, your eyes, and all the rest of it that can be done by that kind of coal, and the acid rain that develops from it. But the natural gas, if nothing else, if we've got a 110-year supply of this shale gas, during that course of that period, the run of this gas, we ought to be developing everything we can that would get us off, if pollution is the issue, off the kind of polluting systems we have. But it's not going to be wind. It's not going to be, unless we have huge acreage to develop for it, going to be solar. It's going to have to be either something involving atoms or something we haven't yet developed, and this gives us some breathing room and stops us from being dependent on foreign fuels, just as I'm sure the Poles are quite anxious to get out from underneath the thumbs of the people who have been one of their historic adversaries. So let's see what Sal's up to. He's got something going on over there. Let's see. Yes, Pavel, the brown coal is a real mess, and it makes for some really nasty weather. Then we see also, I mean, I think that a lot of the cases, the people who they just don't want there to be, this kind of gas, it's one of those excuses that they have, you know, if we keep finding new sources of energy that are petroleum or fossil fuel based, and the excuses to start all these other pie in the sky ideas they have aren't there, and I think that really hurts their feelings, and Lord knows I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. And let's see, I have to go back up here. Well, yeah, the LNG business. The as you know, the a lot of us did a bunch of work on looking at LNG tankers, and it was a very profitable idea to build these tankers. We opened up some LNG ports in the United States because we thought that LNG would be the wave of the future. We would have to import gas. The easiest ways to do that was through these liquefied natural gas tankers, and looks like this still will be useful, but mostly for shipping LNG to Asia. Are you back, okay, Sal?
I sure am. And wait, we've got our guest. So instead of the full hour, we're going to have her for the full 29 minutes and 44 seconds. But we have our guest on. Just as a reminder for everybody, our guest is going to be Amy Myers Jaffe. She is the Wallace S. Wilson Fellow in Energy Studies, Director of the Energy Forum at the Baker Institute. She's also an author and Associate Director of the Rice Energy Program at Rice University. She is one of the co-authors of a paper sponsored by the U.S. Department of Energy from the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University titled Shale Gas and U.S. National Security. As Eagle One mentioned earlier, you can find links to it at his home blog, also at USNI and my home blog. You can get the whole PDF and get some details. And if Byron, if you're listening, it has pictures for you too, so you'll like that. But she has a wide-ranging area of expertise, not just in shale gas, but in the larger energy field. And she also has a lot of expertise in the Arab world and issues revolving about that. But let's move forward. Amy, welcome to MidRats.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's good to have you. And when just to give a chance for you to kind of set the field for us, most people who are concentrated on getting a paycheck and taking care of their families, living their everyday life, when you say natural gas, you know, they'll think of a properly equipped stove for the family foodie or an energy-efficient water heater. But in the second decade of the 21st century, natural gas, it's really much more than that in our national energy infrastructure. If you could just for a moment describe the importance of natural gas in our energy infrastructure.
Well, you know, natural gas has been the growth fuel. To the extent that we use less oil in the United States, or that, you know, sometimes you hear experts say that the oil price went up, but it didn't hurt the economy as much because we're not as oil intensive. The reason we're not as oil intensive is that natural gas moved in a lot of the traditional areas we used to use oil. So, for example, we used to use oil to generate electricity in the United States. Now we don't do that at all. We use almost no oil. Maybe 1% of all electricity generated in the United States is with oil. So we have a high percentage of our electricity now comes from combined cycle thermal plants that burn natural gas. And that proportion is rising all the time. And it's cleaner than coal, so that's a good thing. We also, a lot of Americans have shifted over to using natural gas to heat their homes. And so, you know, back in the day when people here in Texas would talk about freezing people in New York because, you know, they needed the oil to heat their homes, well, that doesn't happen so much anymore because many homeowners across this country use natural gas. And also with industry. We used to, in China today, for example, when they make petrochemicals and all the plastics that we buy here, they use oil to do that manufacturing. Here in the United States, we use natural gas. And then there are a lot of businesses and industries that use natural gas. And then increasingly, we're seeing cities use natural gas to fuel things like buses and fleets and so forth. So it's definitely the fuel of the hour. And the good news about it is that we have a lot of it. We have more natural gas here in the United States from the shale rock than the Middle East can supply. So we really are in a very, very endowed position. And the question is, you know, can we get our regulatory framework to be sound and successful in every state? And therefore, we'll be able to really, you know, use this resource to its highest potential.
Amy, thank you for coming on. one of the questions I have for you, I think I set the stage while we were on before about how all this came to pass, but let's talk about that regulatory scheme before. In the paper, there are a couple of almost inside baseball things. One of them is about the intangible drilling credit for the gas export drilling companies, and the other is the environmental concerns over the drilling of the gas shale. Can you talk about those a little bit?
Sure. Well, one of the interesting things when you think about making policies that, you know, so we come out with the great energy picture and not shortages and not, you know, people from foreign countries having secret meetings to raise the price of oil to the whole globe and so forth. One of the big picture items is how competitive is the industry? And one of the great things about the United States is we don't have a national oil company. The government doesn't manage the sector, and we're not inefficient. So if ExxonMobil decides they're not going to drill or they're going to drill abroad, they find that more attractive. The great thing we have here is we have a lot of independent drillers. And the reason the intangible drilling credit is important is that some of those smaller companies or even individual investor groups, they don't have this massive capital that we think of when we think of the oil companies, the big oil companies. And so a lot of the cost for starting up in shale when people were first looking at it, you have a lot of costs that come at the front end, right? And so being able to write off your expenses before you have first production is important because it's important for cash flow reasons. Otherwise, you might not have the money to invest, or maybe it's going to be too risky. So because we have the IDC, this intangible drilling credit, very small operators could go out to the Barnett Shale and take a flyer, so to speak, kind of like guys who, something in the garage, though there's a lot more science when it comes to drilling. But, in the end, they were highly successful. And we in the country are now reaping the benefit of that. And even though I do feel that, when we go to reduce the deficit, there are certainly a lot of tax credits that the oil industry gets that they don't need. But the intangible drilling credit had a very positive effect on the development and rebirth of the American industry. To the point where, again, we're going to be very self-sufficient in natural gas, and we have a lot of potential to have a higher use of our own domestic resources. And that credit was one of the major features that allowed us to be there. But, and here's the but, sometimes in when you have a lot of small operators working in an industry, not everybody has what we call industry standard best practices. And that's been a problem, especially in places where the state did not have experience in regulating the energy industry. So maybe in a place like Louisiana or Texas, not such a big problem, right? If landowners were to report that they're concerned about water contamination or some concerns about water scarcity. States that have a lot of natural resource know how to manage that. They've been managing that for, 100 years. Whereas someplace like upstate New York, no one's drilled for oil or gas in upstate New York in decades. And so they don't really have regulators don't really have the experience and the frameworks and setups and inspectors and so forth. And so there's going to be a little bit of a catch-up. But generally speaking, a lot of the problems that people have written about are things that are fairly solvable. And I like to sort of use the example of such a tragedy of the Macondo accident because, we all looked on in horror when we realized that the oil industry did not have a way of capping a well once there was a blowout. that their emphasis had been on prevention and that they didn't have a system. But when the administration said no one's drilling again until you have a system, you know, interestingly, the industry was able to come up with a system. I mean, they did in the end cap this BP well, and they did in the end develop these two companies, one consortium and one other private company, that have containment systems for blowouts now. And the technology was developed pretty rapidly, and I feel that's going to be the same thing with shale gas and water. We're already developing, a lot of the companies are developing new techniques to use recycled water so that they're not having to take fresh water and you're not putting pressure on local water sources. We're also seeing a lot of companies, Schlumberger, for example, developing non-toxic drilling fluids so that if, God forbid, there is some kind of an accidental leak, the fluids that would leak out are not going to be harmful to human health. And so you're seeing a lot of change coming in the industry, and you know, promoting that change is a regulatory question. You know, what kind of requirements do we need to put down to make sure that we can pursue this resource in a way that's also safe and environmentally sound?
And, you know, that's always been, you know, one of our strengths as a nation is the diverse nature of our economy and the companies in it. You can get a lot of innovation there because people are given the opportunity to fail. But in those attempts, there's occasional failure, but there also is a lot of great technology that comes out of it. From a looking at it from a little bit from a security point of view, when, you know, like when I was a wee one, the memory goes back to the OPEC oil embargo of the early 70s, but control of sources of energy has a long history of being used as a weapon, either from the ones using it as a weapon or from the perceived people on the receiving end. You know, our embargo of energy against Japan prior to World War II is an older example, but there's other ones. But when you look at who's blessed traditionally with energy sources, whether it's oil or gas, you know, besides our friendly neighbors to the north and the south here and a couple European nations, you really don't have the most enlightened nations in the world that are blessed with this. This new technology, though, to access and harness previously inaccessible sources of natural gas, does that open up other countries to be able to provide their own domestic supplies or to bring more suppliers onto the general market?
Well, I mean, I think the thing that's just amazing about the shale resource is, you know, you make allusion to it. So it's not just whether the countries we're getting our oil from are stable or not stable or whether they're hostile or not hostile. All those things are problematic. But there's also a problem in just having them be very distant. And, you know, you're having to send things by ships, and we all, you know, heard about the Somali pirates, and we all know, you know, Al-Qaeda made a pronouncement that they're going to attack tankers. And, you know, we can sort of see the handwriting about the insecurity of the sort of supply chain. And frankly, I think the industry does a pretty amazing job getting the resource to us, you know, given the tenuous nature of the supply chain. So having the resource be exactly where you use it is of a great advantage, you know, both on the basis of cost, but definitely on the basis of security. And it's not just that shale gas is here in the United States, you know, right here in places where people, you know, turn on the lights, and therefore it's the resources right where we use it. But that's also going to be true in Europe, right? You have countries like Poland, Austria, Germany, France are turning out to have this same resource that could be developed. China's already tendering acreage for drilling for natural gas from shale. People are talking about maybe South Africa and other places. So, I mean, I think what you're going to find is it's like the first time somebody realized that they could drill for oil offshore, or then later, you know, offshore in the deep water, and it turned out there's just giant resources around the world. This is going to be just a revolutionary boom everywhere. I mean, there's a lot of places that use a lot of energy that are going to be able to utilize this resource that are currently relying on distant, insecure resource.
Well, one of the things in the article I thought was interesting was you pointed out that one of the advantages that the independent drillers had was they didn't have to provide for a pipeline system. That, as far as the United States goes, there's already a pipeline structure pretty well set up that allowed them to exploit the gas if they found it. Do we see that same situation in Poland, or and some of the other countries that have this asset, or is it going to be a longer row for them to hoe as they try and develop the infrastructure to deal with the gas if they've got it?
Well, it's definitely going to be a longer lead time in Europe and China and other places, and it's partly infrastructure. Though some places there is infrastructure, but you have a lot of government interference in the business of energy. Throughout Europe, you have a lot of state monopolies. They don't have what we call an unbundled pipeline system. So there's no here in the United States. If I find gas in Barnett, Texas, and I want to sell it and move it on El Paso's pipeline, and they have their own gas, by law, El Paso has to carry my gas equally with theirs, right? They can't just tell me I can't transport. And that goes back to the history of the trust busters with Standard Oil. So we have a long tradition of enforcing competition and open access to infrastructure. And Europe is moving in that direction slowly. So I think that eventually the European market will be like that. But they're just starting to address that now in Western Europe. And it's still slow going in the Baltics and Eastern Europe and so forth. So that is going to be a difference. It is going to be a difference. And then you also have, you know, government players who have a stake and an interest in preventing there from being outright competition, you know, especially with the Russians, for example. I mean, there are a lot of independent owners now since the fall of the Soviet Union of natural gas resources in Russia, but like you're describing, they can't get access to pipelines, and they can't get access to export that gas to Europe. Everything has to go through the state monopoly. So as those things change over time, and I think there is pressure in Europe, at least, for that to change. China's a different system, but it will be slower in those parts of the world.
There's an interesting graph on page 27 of your report, because we talked earlier about finding non-toxic drilling fluids and being below the aquifer, but there's a significant requirement for ready access to water in order to be able to do this. When you look at China, which is more and more dramatically trying to find additional resources, it seems that some of their better formations, especially in Western China, otherwise known as the Gobi Desert in East Turkestan, those are also the areas that they have significant access problems with water. And there's been a lot of scholarship done about mid-century and on here water wars and the ongoing conflicts you're going to see over access to water. As this technology develops and you get an additional push to try to access this shale oil, does that potentially compound the problems that we're going to see on access to good water for agricultural and human use? Or are there some technologies that are developing that may mitigate that conflict from being a little more exacerbated in the pursuit of energy?
Well, I think that, we just had a decision, I don't know, it was last week or the week before, in the state of Pennsylvania where people were unable to get water permits. Specifically because of concerns about shortages for other purposes. So, I mean, it's definitely a constraint. And, I'm of the mind that if there's resource to develop, and it's what you were saying before, and there's money to be made, if I innovate and come up with a way of obviating this water problem, I think the companies will come up with ways to do that. And one way, which they're already experimenting with, is to recycle water. And one of the things they found in early stages of doing that is that the recycled water actually works better than fresh water. And so I think that'll take some pressure off there. But there are companies innovating, looking at things which are currently expensive, but perhaps the cost would come down over time. One is to use nitrogen for fracking. The other one is to use propane. So I think that we'll see over time people will come up with different technologies that will lower the need for water. And indeed, even, you know, I'm at Rice University, and we're very famous for nanotechnology, and we've developed some nano ceramic sand where when you blast it into the rock, the nano sand makes bigger porousness in the rock, and so therefore it takes a lot less water to do the same activity. So I think you're going to see a lot of innovation like that, and there'll be a solution. My opinion is there'll be a solution to that part of the problem. But it is a big constraint in China, and there are going to be areas where the Chinese really aren't going to be able to do shale because there's just not enough water.
You point out in the paper that the LNG system, much of which was being set up to import LNG to the United States and to some of the Western countries, may now be flipped to provide LNG, to liquefied natural gas, to Asia. And does this shale gas is certainly good for U.S. national security. Does this create another security issue that the Chinese are going to worry about? That they, if they have to import LNG, is this a weakness for them? Are we going to see them get more ramped up about some of these security at sea issues?
Well, you know, the Chinese, I mean, that if you look into the sort of what I call the so-called security literature, like what do people who are in think tanks in China, of course, in China think tanks are government-run, but you still have people who are academics who do nothing but study security, and there's just this giant body of C-Lane security writing in China about the problem of the Chinese having to rely on the American Navy to keep their energy supply secure. And I think that when you're a Chinese military officer, a senior military leader, and you want to get a budget to expand your equipment, especially for the Chinese Navy and so forth, one of the big arguments is being able to manage these sea lanes for energy supply. And I think one of the most interesting things that's happened in the last year that was, I think, noticed in the energy industry, but maybe not by the general public, is that China was very involved in Libya, for example. And then all of a sudden they realized that they had 30,000 people to evacuate, and that's pretty hard to do without a navy. And that's hard to do without a blue water navy. And so, ironically, because the Chinese have been trying to move into a more cooperative framework, they were on a initiative to help with the problem of the Somali pirates, and therefore they had a frigate available to rescue Chinese oil workers and other kinds of construction workers in Libya. But they had to evacuate 30,000 people. And so that, I think, also will change the debate in China about what's necessary for their own energy supply. But you see the Chinese understanding the same thing now that we understood intuitively because many of us lived through 1973. You know, China was self-sufficient in 1973. They were self-sufficient in 79. They were even self-sufficient in 1990 when Iraq invaded Kuwait. So it wasn't a concern of theirs. They had a closed economy, command economy, where they set the price of their own energy to their own industry, and they didn't have to import. So they didn't have to worry about global problems in energy. Now they do. And now that they do, you see a lot of Chinese companies investing in oil and gas resources in Canada, oil and gas resources in the United States, and oil and gas resources in Latin America, because they, too, don't want to be dependent on insecure supply from the Middle East or from Russia and others. So they're sort of groping around with the same problems now. And I do think that they'd very much like to develop more resources of unconventional natural gas in China, and that is going to require them to manage some water issues in certain parts of the country.
Amy, I'm going to give you one of my classic, suitable for a PhD dissertation, but I'm going to give you 4.5 minutes to chew on it. You know, we talk about the security issues, but there's also some macroeconomic issues. We saw just a few months ago, President Obama was down praising Brazil's great discovery of some offshore petroleum and saying, we're going to help you with it. While at the same time, there was a lot of pushback from our federal government against domestic development, not just of shale gas, but also continental shelf. And even in West Texas, we're seeing additional regulatory pressure. And, of course, the ongoing problems of Alaska of trying to access domestic sources of hydrocarbons. There is an economic component to this with the balance of payments deficit. And what is the economic advantage outside of security of being able to develop your own energy sources inside the lifelines of your own country?
Well, I mean, there's just, you know, I mean, 4.5 minutes, it's hard. I mean, there's huge benefits. First of all, every person we're paying to produce domestic natural gas, the money's staying here. Right, so we're paying an American who's working in that industry, and then he's going out and going out to dinner, and that's creating jobs, you know, all around. So, and I think that, you know, one of the things that sort of is, even though it seems when you're reading the press and so forth that the environmental movement is really, you know, out there beating the drum and everybody's agreeing with them, you know, in the end, no one's really agreeing with them, and that is because the state of Pennsylvania can't afford to not drill because it's money for the state, it's money for local people, it's jobs, right? And you're seeing that in North Dakota. So that's you know, sort of easy point one. Easy point, more complicated point two is if I'm having to import a lot of oil and gas from abroad, then I'm paying dollars out to other countries, and therefore my trade deficit is high, and that puts, you know, pressure on the dollar and brings us into these cycles. And the other part of the cycle, which I think is not as well understood, is if I'm shifting, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars to Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or some of these countries that have very thin economies because I have to pay a lot of money for oil and gas, then what happens is that money can't really be absorbed in new manufacturing, at least when we were, you know, buying and selling with the Chinese. It's a very deep economy in China. Well, that's not true in the Middle East, generally speaking, or even a place like Venezuela or Nigeria. So what happens is these petrodollars build up, and what people may have heard of the reference to the sovereign wealth funds. And so you get this bubble of money that has to come back into the international financial system as an investment. And so who's investing it? I mean, you know, it's being invested in London real estate or in subprime mortgage paper, and it's causing these bubbles, which then we all know what happens when there's a big bubble in something. It pops, and then we have a financial crisis. So, you know, it's to our advantage to keep the revenue from energy, our high energy use. I mean, it would be great if we could lower our energy use, but to the extent that we're having high energy use, you know, it'd be great to keep those dollars here and spend them here. And then the final point, which I think is already happening, which is, you know, as I mentioned, the independents here develop these really innovative technologies, and you've got companies trying to make, you know, environmentally friendly drilling fluids and nitrogen systems and waterless fracking and ceramic nano sands and all these different things, 4D seismic monitoring, so I know I have a leak, so I can just shut down and fix it. So there are all kinds of new technologies that are being developed here in the United States. And then when Poland or China or Germany or South Africa want to move into shale, what are they going to have to buy? They're going to have to buy American technologies developed by American engineers, and they're going to have to hire Americans to help them learn how to do it and implement it and buy the technology and buy the products. And those things are going to be things that are being sold from the United States. And we're going to see the American industry, in my opinion, have, you know, yet another renaissance when people were counting us out. So it's a really big success story. And I think that it's been colored by, you know, these stories about, you know, incidents of contamination somewhere in the state of Pennsylvania. But the big story is, you know, America, it's not just Apple Computer. We have this giant innovation going on in the American natural gas industry that's going to become a global business. And we're the leaders.
And I think that's the key right now. And I have family in the Gulf Coast area of Louisiana, Mississippi, and these are jobs that are real jobs, that are real money, support huge economies, and the second and third order effects on that. And I think that's the big message right there. It's an opportunity for us to, again, take advantage of what is a great American trait, that's innovation and responding to needs well. And boy, if there is ever a time for a message on something to create good, long, good-paying jobs, now is the time for that. And Amy, thank you very much for taking time this Sunday to come on MidRats. If people are more interested in reading some of the material that y'all are developing over at Rice University, where would be a good place for them to go to access that?
Well, if they just come to www.rice.edu/energy, that'll bring you to our energy policy website, and from there, if you're interested in the science part, you just have to click on different aspects. So we have a lot of policy and market forecasts and outlooks for the oil and gas industry, but there are also links to, you know, people are interested in technological innovation in the energy space and renewable energy and so forth. They can launch into the Rice website from that URL. And there are a lot of materials available for the public. That's really our mission, is to have the public be educated. Educated public is the first step to sound public policy.
There you go, and I encourage everybody to go check it out and educate yourself some more, because it's a lot more than stoves and hot water heaters. Amy, I hope you have a great summer, and we look forward to talking to you again.
I look forward to talking to you again, too. Thanks very much.
Thank you for joining us, Amy, and the article is just terrific. Thank you very much.
All right, very good. We'll catch you guys soon.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us live, and we will hope to catch you again on another episode of MidRats. And until then, hope everybody has a great Navy Day.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.